Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and novelist Paul Cody. Cody is a graduate of both the University of Massachusetts at Boston and Cornell University, where he received his MFA. He has published four acclaimed novels, The Stolen Child, Eyes Like Mine, So Far Gone, and Shooting the Heart. His most recent book is a tough and heartfelt memoir called The Last Next Time. It's about his often painful journey of addiction and recovery. It was published by Irving Place Editions in July of this year. And welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish. Good to be here.
There have been so many memoirs written about addiction, recovery. What made you decide to throw your story into the mix?
I guess because it was what I had to write about. It was the thing before me. And in the first year after I got out of rehab in 2009, it was sort of the thing, not just to write for reasons of, you know, to have something cathartic, but also to keep the main issue in my life front and center. So in a way, I wrote it to stay clean and sober.
Wow, that's a really interesting reason for doing that. Now, you started doing drugs around the age of 13. Did you recall what lured you? Was it just the culture or what?
Yeah, I guess it was the culture. It was the late 60s, early 70s. It was in suburban Boston, which was a kind of a loose and liberal and progressive place. They were available. And I guess it went with rock and roll and being a teenager back then. But I just started, you know, drinking a little bit and taking pills, and it just evolved very quickly for me, or devolved, or went downhill.
Yeah, it certainly did devolve for you. That's the way it looked from your descriptions in your book. Now, you ended up also going to psychiatrists and being treated for depression, and that's where you start getting pills prescribed. Tell us about that.
Well, it was, you know, when I probably in my mid-teens to late teens, back in the bad 70s, a decade that fills me with, I don't know, it makes me shudder. But I had a lot of headaches. I had migraine headaches, fair amount of anxiety, depression, all that stuff. And I started seeing shrinks and started taking pills, pills for headaches, pills like Furanol, which had a barbiturate and a opiate. I started taking Valium and Librium, the early benzodiazepines. And it just, in a basic human way, it relieved pain. It relieved anxiety. It made things it sort of oiled the social gears, and things came a little bit painlessly.
Mm-hmm. Did doctors ever ask you about how much you drank, and did they ever suggest that was causing your depression?
Very little. Back in the 70s, almost never. I mean, they would give you, for me at least, they would give me prescriptions pretty easily, and if I walked in there with penny loafers and an Oxford shirt and looked pretty clean cut, they didn't much question the drugs they gave you. They didn't seem real aware of addiction and the issues around addiction.
Yeah. But around the age of 23, you finally got some help and started on your journey to become clean and sober. Tell us what precipitated that.
Everything accelerated for me. I mean, it was sort of that people talk about alcoholism and addiction as progressive diseases, and I went down pretty fast. I mean, I just was, things became unmanageable, as they say in AA. And when I was, I believe, 23, I was taken to a state mental hospital. In fact, the place where Shutter Island was filmed, Medfield State Hospital, southwest of Boston. And I was committed there for 30 days because I had taken a swing at a doctor in an emergency room. And you don't do that. It was not a good idea. It wasn't a good career move. And I got committed for 30 days with pink paper. And that was sort of the end of my drinking and drugs when I was 23.
Yeah, that's how you describe it in the book. Well, what were your parents doing during all this? Were they helpful, or were they just horrified?
I think they were, it's hard to say. I mean, they were probably bewildered. They couldn't understand what was going on with me. I think they tried. I think they were present. They did the best they could. But I think they were really overmatched in so many ways. I mean, financially, psychologically, they were very busy. There were five kids. So I think they did their best, but they had no idea what addiction was or what alcoholism was. Yeah. And that's a pretty tough position to be in. I mean, you're completely overmatched, not only by the addict, but by the disease itself.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It's a tough place to be.
What about your siblings? Were they involved? Were they helping you? Were they co-ing you?
They were around. I guess they were trying to grow up as we were all trying to grow up, and they were busy. None of them were addicted or alcoholic. Everyone was either going to school or working, just doing the best they could. And I think they too were just looking at me and saying, what is going on with this guy? Why is he such a mess? Why can't he pull himself up by his bootstraps and deal with it? And in a lot of ways, I didn't know what was going on either. I thought I was crazy. I mean, a lot of addicts will tell you that just bizarre stuff happens. And I think the whole sense of what addiction and alcoholism were back then was pretty limited. People didn't really get it. And I think that's changed a lot over the years. But anyway, I bottomed out in the state hospital, came out, went to AA, went to college, became a good citizen for quite a few years, for 25 years.
And then you ended up getting married and having two sons after this time.
Mm-hmm.
And did they help to keep you sober for all? You stayed sober pretty much for 25 years.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I came away from that experience in the state hospital, and I guess the years of drinking and using drugs, really scared. I mean, thinking, my God, I did not plan to be in a state hospital locked up. And yet there I was, and I thought, I can't believe this has happened. And it became pretty clear to me that it was because of alcohol and drugs. So I stayed straight. I didn't drink, didn't use drugs for a long time. And in many ways, my life completely changed. I became relatively successful. I went to college. I did well. I worked with developmentally disabled kids. Then I went to graduate school. So everything I had hoped for, in a way, came true.
Yeah. So tell us what happened when you were 48, 25 years after having gone through all this, you decided that you could have a drink.
Yes, not very smart. It was funny because I started thinking in terms of, I haven't been sober and clean a year or a week or a month or even a decade. I'd been sober at that point a quarter century. And my wife and I were pretty comfortable. We had a good marriage. The house was paid off. We both had terrific jobs. We had two fine, sterling kids. And I was still struggling some with depression, with anxiety, with things like that. But at a certain point, I don't know why or how, but it was to the very month, November, 25 years after I'd gotten sober, that I was home late one night. I was tired. I was just anxious, tired, all the usual things. There happened to be a bottle of old Wild Turkey that we kept in the house for my mother-in-law. And the kids had gone to bed. My wife had gone to bed. It had been a long day. And I just poured a tall glass of Wild Turkey. And it was astonishing what happened. Mm. I mean, it was within an hour or two, I was dead drunk. But I remember thinking, well, I didn't burn the house down or kick the cat or do anything egregious. So I drank for several days, for 3, 4, 5 days, and I went down with astonishing rapidity. I mean, I ended up being in a psychiatric ward about 5 days later.
Gosh.
Just completely dysfunctional with this awful, dark depression. And Things got worse from there.
Yeah. How did your wife react to that? I know you talk in the memoir about how you explained to her about your early life. She had never seen you in this state. And how did she react with you drunk up in your studio for days?
Well, I think she was bewildered. I think she was astonished. She didn't know what to do. And like a lot of lay people, people are just mystified and baffled by addiction and alcoholism and the way it plays out. I kept telling her, no, it wasn't addiction, it was depression. Mm. It was really hard to parse it in a way. I mean, there was always a part of me that knew this was a really catastrophic thing to do and a really dangerous thing to do.
So you never, like a lot of alcoholics I've known, told yourself, I can just have one. You weren't trying to deceive yourself in that way, or were you at first?
It's hard to say. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess there was some part of me that thought, here I am 25 years later, a lot has changed. I'm more or less a relatively successful human being, so I can be a normal person and have a drink like everyone else. But, you know, I poured like a 10 or 12 ounce glass of Wild Turkey over the rocks, and within an hour I was drunk.
It's so heartbreaking when I read that passage in the book. Yeah.
It's, you know, looking back, I think, what a stupid thing to have done. I would have thought I could have learned. I had always heard that this is a progressive disease, that it's not going to get better. And somehow, that was one thing I didn't quite buy. It didn't make sense to me that even though I'd been clean and sober for 25 years, the disease, in a way, was progressing. And it was as though I had been drinking and taking drugs that entire time. And it was shocking, astonishing to me how quickly I went down. I mean, it was extraordinarily fast.
Yeah. Did you think during all those years when you were a successful novelist, are still a successful writer, did you think that kept you from the alcohol? Did the success help you at all with your depression and your negative feelings?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of... there was a part of me that always knew this everything in my life is contingent on me being clean and sober. Mm. And that, I mean, I knew that. In some way, I knew it in my bones that was the case. But there's always this sort of dark angel whispering in the corner. I mean, it's always there, thinking, well, you're normal now. You're good now. You've paid a lot of dues. You've worked hard. Things have come a long way. And I think there was a part of me, some tiny part of me, maybe 5% of me, that thought, well, maybe I could get away with it. Hmm. Maybe I could be fully normal, whatever that was.
Yeah.
And in a certain way, I thought, well, I deserve this. I deserve to feel good, to have that spreading warmth, that release of anxiety. Yes, you know, it's time, you worked hard, time to kick back and have a drink.
Did you always, during those 25 years, miss that feeling that alcohol can... that warmth that alcohol can spread and that feeling of well-being and, you know, ability to be social without being self-conscious and so on?
I think there was always a part of me that wanted it. I mean, I think in a way it's like the human thing to want to avoid pain and anxiety. But I think I always, for those 25 years, kept it clear in my mind that I can't do that. I can't go there. I mean, my experience with it was just devastating. It was terrible. Yeah. I feel like if I had kept going, I would have been a dead man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And yet, there's always, I don't think you ever quite put it to rest. It doesn't go to sleep. It's like, if you're diabetic, you have to keep taking your insulin. If you're an alcoholic and an addict, you have to remember what it was like when you were doing it. And you can't lie to yourself about it. And I think all of us, in some ways, particularly with addicts, we want to believe that it wasn't that bad. And it's always hugely ironic that the one thing that for an hour or two could make you feel absolutely wonderful, absolutely, you know, warm and at one with the world, that it's the same thing that's going to kill you, that's going to make you feel miserable.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Cody. We're talking about his memoir, The Last Next Time. It's about his painful journey of addiction and recovery. Now, during this period when you started drinking again, you also started taking pills again.
Right.
And you found this incredible access on the internet to drugs, which shocked me, really, that you could get such a quantity of drugs on the internet.
Yeah, I originally, when I came out of the hospital, the psychiatric ward, after drinking for the first time in 25 years, I was taking some antidepressants, some of the usual, I don't know, Prozac or Zoloft or one of those. And I went to see a psychiatrist, and part of the depression for me, as it is in many cases, was a lot of anxiety. And a psychiatrist prescribed some benzodiazepines for me. I believe it was Ativan or lorazepam is the generic name. And it was a tiny dose. It was a baby dose, a quarter of a milligram four times a day. And it helped. It helped enormously. It really took down the edge of the anxiety, the depression. And I did quite well with it for many, many months. It was not a problem. They were medically prescribed. But I don't know, within 6-8 months, I remember one time looking up on the internet, I typed in either lorazepam or Valium diazepam, whatever, I can't even pronounce it. But when I typed it in, I suddenly hit all these sites. I mean, hundreds and thousands of sites that said, buy Valium online, buy Klonopin online, and I was shocked. I thought, what is this? Surely this is, they've got to be selling you sugar pills. And I started looking around at these sites, and more I thought, well, if this drug is making me feel good and I'm on such a tiny dose, maybe a couple pills wouldn't hurt. And it didn't seem like alcohol, and that it took me down so quickly. So I ordered some pills online. I don't remember where they came from. It was somewhere overseas. And a week or two later, a plain brown package arrived with maybe 100 Valium or Ativan. And I thought, oh my, what a revelation. And that sort of got me started on this pretty serious addiction to benzos.
Oh, that's unbelievable to me. And do they ask you any questions? And not that you couldn't lie, but I mean, how do you know you're not a 12-year-old kid?
Yeah, I mean, a 12-year-old kid could order this stuff. I mean, all you need is a credit card and access to the internet. I think they ask you like 10 questions, name, address, height, weight, what do you want this for? And then they say, does your doctor know you're ordering this? Mm. And of course I lied and said, yeah, my doctor knows this. And you just pay, you know, pay $100 or $200 or whatever it is. And more often than not, in my experience anyway, you got a plain brown package with a whole lot of pills.
Wow, I couldn't believe that. I could not believe that. So you were getting prescriptions from your psychiatrist. You must have stopped going back for more prescriptions. And
I did
and
after a while.
Didn't she wonder what was happening?
Yeah, but I was less than frank, to put it, I don't know, delicately. I was lying. I mean, I was lying to myself. I thought I was handling it. I was teaching full time. I was teaching in a prison at night. I was writing books. I was being a more or less decent husband and father. But it was sort of this secret thing I had that I could, I guess there was this transgressive thing, like, I can get away with this. This is okay. I'm functioning. I pay my taxes. I don't break the law. Although, you know, to be perfectly honest, ordering, you know, scheduled drugs like Valium or Klonopin online is illegal. You're not supposed to have that. But I confined it to my office on the third floor. I didn't go out driving around. I didn't do crazy things. And it just went on, and then I'd pull back from it. I'd say, I got to stop this. But it really became this spiral downward.
Oh, I can imagine. I couldn't believe that. The first thing that went through my head was, we're creating a nation of zombies, and this is how.
Yeah, benzodiazepines seem so benign in so many ways. It's like,
well, especially the small doses that they give.
Yeah, the tiny doses, you take a little baby dose, and I think they can be extremely valuable. You know, they're used for anxiety, they're used for insomnia, preoperative sedation, stuff like that. But they can also be very, very insidious and really hard to get off of. It's, you know, I've withdrawn in my life from barbiturates, from opiates, from alcohol. For me, benzodiazepines were by far the toughest to kick. It took a long time. It just scrambles your brain in all sorts of ways. Yeah. It alters your chemistry.
That's what I was going to say. It stays in your body for maybe years.
Yeah,
the way it scrambles your...
It does, and it's like it poisons your soul in all kinds of ways that you can't even realize till you begin to withdraw. But it took me at least a year and a half to fully withdraw from the stuff. It was just very, very slow, very drawn out. There's this sense of what they call, well, it's almost this dystopian feeling that everything is hopeless, a lot of anxiety, a lot of panic, a lot of insomnia. So as sweet and nice and benign as these drugs are, and they won't kill you the way barbiturates would, you know, put you into respiratory arrest pretty quickly, benzos don't do that. But in some ways, because they seem so benign, in some ways they're a lot more vicious.
Yeah, yeah. You talk a lot about your time in rehab during the second bout of drinking when you were in your late 40s. So tell us a little bit about that. You describe some of the people that you met, and it's so much of it is so touching.
Yeah, I had never been to a rehab, and I went there, let's see, it was probably in my mid-50s. I went there because I felt I had to. I couldn't stop taking these drugs. I needed to do something radical and just be put in a kind of bubble, a therapeutic bubble for a while. So I went to a place called the Care and Treatment Center near Reading, Pennsylvania, and I spent 37 days there. And it was a kind of fairly upscale rehab. I think a lot of rock and roll stars and movie stars went there over the years. And when I was there for a little over a month, and I met all kinds of people. I mean, heroin addicts, huffers, meth heads, pill poppers, drunks, addicts of, you know, people who had gambling addictions. And it was this very isolated, very cushy place in a lot of ways. The food was good. There were a lot of flowers. It was on a mountaintop in a former spa. But in other ways, it was tough. You know, withdrawal is painful. It's extremely, it's wrenching in all kinds of ways. And as a guy there said, a man named Father Bill, who was sort of the spiritual advisor to the place, he said, if you don't remember your last detox, you've probably not had it yet. Mm. And it was not fun. I mean, it was a difficult, difficult time, but it was enormously helpful in all kinds of ways, because you're put there with people who are like you. There were doctors there, lawyers, businessmen. There was a mixed martial arts fighter. There were all kinds of interesting people. There were soldiers and cops. And in a way, we were all there in the same leaky lifeboat, going through the same thing, smoking a lot of cigarettes.
I was going to say, you started smoking cigarettes again during that time.
It was the only thing they would let us have. We couldn't have coffee with caffeine in it. It was like no internet access, no music, no books except for recovery literature. So the only thing we had left was we smoked a lot of cigarettes. I would sit out at 3 a.m. with the heroin addicts in particular, and they all smoked menthols. And we'd just sit there and talk, and very few people could sleep. So it was fascinating. It was exhausting. Looking back, it was one of the best things I ever did in my life, because yeah. It sort of got my attention and took me out of the world in a I think a really productive way. And I've been clean and sober since then.
Yeah, God, applause. And I just want my listeners to know that you must go read his book. It's really an amazing road that you've been on during this time. Now, the thing that a lot of people still, the fallacy that's out there, are that a lot of people who get into drugs are down and outers, poor people right. with no tools, no right. access. Yep. But you clearly are not one of those people, and you didn't meet people that were such stereotypes for the most part.
No, I mean, that is the old stereotype, like, you know, the wino with the bottle in the bag, mm-hmm. sleeping on the streets. But addicts and alcoholics come in all shapes and sizes, all religions, all colors, all, you know, it's at Karen, two of my best friends, one was a physician, he was a hematologist, who had gotten addicted to Ativan, not Ativan, I'm sorry, to the sleep medication, Zolderperm, which is supposed to be non-addictive. Yeah. But there's all kinds of people who are addicts, and, you know, they come in all shapes and sizes. And people can be addicted in all kinds of ways. There can be high, what they call, you know, high-bottom drunks and addicts who are functioning, who are driving around, working, raising kids, and mm-hmm. and they're popping pills or they're drinking. Usually it almost always will get worse if someone's an addict. Sometimes it takes a lot longer for some people than others, but I don't know. There's got to be tens of millions of addicts in this country, and they're not all out in the streets by any means.
That's right.
Sometimes they're driving nice cars and living in nice suburbs. And
you know, I met somebody when I was in California. This guy, he was a really successful producer in Hollywood, and he told me that he never thought he was an alcoholic because he could afford Chavez Regal.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, and then there was a way, I think, initially when I was taking benzos in, you know, right around 2000, around in those years, I thought, well, this is okay because I'm getting it from a doctor, from a psychiatrist who is trained. And I had told her I'm an alcoholic, an addict, and she said, well, this is a new kind of medication. It's less addictive. Just keep me informed how it's going. And had I done that, things would have probably been okay, because within 6 months, 8 months, I was ordering them online. I was taking far more than I should have. And, I mean, I guess the lesson in all this for me is that I just can't do that stuff in any form. It's dynamite for me. Mm-hmm. It's like juggling explosives. It's going to get bad. It's going to turn into some very, very dark places I never imagined going.
Since all you have been through, do you worry about this culture where they are prescribing drugs that, change the personalities and minds of kids? You know, everybody's being diagnosed with ADD. I mean, what is this doing?
Yeah, I mean, my sense is, I think, particularly ADHD, I think that's probably way overdiagnosed, probably way overprescribed. I mean, the amphetamines people are getting is, I think if a kid, particularly boys, is energetic, doesn't sit carefully, and, you know, is a little bit energetic, it's really easy and quick to say, well, let's get this kid diagnosed, mm-hmm. let's get him on some drugs. Yeah, it's pretty alarming. I think obviously these drugs can save people's lives, can really help. Antidepressants mm-hmm. are hugely helpful and beneficial to many, many people. But I think if someone has a tendency or a proclivity to abuse drugs, to try to avoid pain or depression or anxiety or whatever it is, there's going to be real trouble. And it's very hard to regulate these things. It's sometimes, I would imagine it's very hard for doctors to really understand in a 10 or 20 minute visit, is this person, how depressed, what drug would work? Will this person take these drugs the way they're supposed to be? Will they start abusing them? And then an addict isn't going to tell a doctor, I'm abusing this drugs, because then you get your supply shut off.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very tricky, very difficult question, and it's not, there's no easy answers, but I think there needs to be a much greater awareness of the potential for addiction and abuse.
We only have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you about when you got ready to write this memoir. Did you worry about revealing too much? Did you worry about putting the family into it? How did that discussion go?
I thought about that. I mean, there's a point for me where I thought, this is what it is. It's the sort of, I'm a writer. I write often from my own experience, from what I know, what I've felt, what I've seen. And in many ways, it was like, well, this is what I was going to do in the first year after I got out of rehab. I was going to do it because it was cathartic. I was going to do it because it would keep the issue of alcohol and drugs right in front of me and would help me really examine it and work it over. I guess, too, after I finished that, I cringed a little. I thought, what about all those nice people I know who have no experience of addiction? What are they going to think about it? And I guess I finally thought, well, I'm a writer. This is what I do. I'll just put it out there. And people can take it for what it is. I mean, it may be a lot of different things to different people. Yeah. But I guess in a certain way, I did choose to write about this. And I certainly have agency here. But I also think I can only control what I can control, and beyond that, you know, people can make what they will of it.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful book. We are almost out of time. What are you working on now? Quickly, anything?
I'm about 80, 90 pages into a new novel,
a
work of fiction, and I'm just, slogging along, seeing what will happen.
And do you have any contact information people can get in touch, or a place where they can buy your book?
They can get the book. It's at Buffalo Street Books. It's on Amazon, so it's out there. It's around.
Great, great. Well, Paul Cody, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called The Last Next Time, and it's about his painful journey of addiction and recovery. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tish. It's been great to be here.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.